Okay. All right. I'm Kevin Farnham, the Java.NET editor, and I'm with Adam Bean, and we're going to be talking about rethinking best practices for Java 6.
Yes, hello. I would like to introduce myself. My name is Adam Bean. I'm expert group member of Java 6 and EGP 3, and I have one project on Java.NET with the name P4J5, patents for Java A5. And the slides cover actually the project on Java.NET. So I'm also working on a book with the same title, Real World Java A6 Patents. Okay, so I would like start to fight some pre-assumptions against EGP 3.1 to explain you what's actually wrong with the common mindset that EGPs are too heavyweight or even too complex. So what I encounter in my project, I see a lot of small pre-assumptions that Java A5 is too complex, too heavyweight, it's not good testable. And so what I did, I would like to explain you why it is not the case anymore. J214 was heavyweight, but now it changed significantly. So the first point are EGPs are heavyweight, and if you look at EGP 3.1 or 3.0, they are actually not. They are very, very lightweight. You don't need, there is no XML. You can actually go with one single annotations and deploy a transactional and concurrent service. Without this annotation, you had to implement everything by yourself. So for instance, provide your interceptors and so forth. So you get all container services for free, especially monitoring, for instance. So you know how many instances are working for you and so forth with single annotation. And even more interesting, the whole EGP 3.1 API are about 50K, so jar. And the container, for instance, Glass HV3 are 800K kilobytes. So it's a really, really lean container, and it's got embeddable. So you can start a container, and it takes about 1 second to fire up the container outside. The next pre-assumptions are EGPs are not portable. So it was the case in J2E14 timeline because you had many vendor extensions. So there were deployment descriptors, they were specific to the vendor, but since EGP3 it changed. So actually the extensions died, so there is nothing else left than the standard. So EGP3 applications are very portable. So you can port from JBoss, move to GlassFish, and from GlassFish to Geronimo. So it's not a problem because the whole jar contains only classes with annotated classes and no XML and no proprietary annotations. They come from the standard.
Now, I think the impression that EGPs are too heavyweight. I mean, is that in part simply because there are so many options for what you can do, so people assume that you have to know about everything, you can't just use it in a simple way?
The problem is the history, I guess. So in EGP2 era, you had the problem, the programming model was too complicated. So you had a class, and this class then implemented your public view. You had to think about some conventions, and they were not backed up by the compiler. So you could do a lot of mistakes, and then you need specific tools like Xdocklet, and those tools generated you the whole infrastructure, but it got slow. So you need a generator to work efficiently with J2E14, and the generator took time. So you need 20 seconds, 30 seconds for a mid-range project to deploy. And this changed dramatically. There is no generator needed, and the options are still available, but they are optional. So there is convention over configuration. Does mean, okay, in the standard case, there is nothing to configure. You just need one specific annotation that it is. Not portable. They are very portable, and actually you can port EGP2 applications to EGP3 without rewriting your business logic, because you can provide on your old EGP legacy or EGP2 beans annotations, and they got deployed as EGP3. So it's a very interesting migration option, actually. The next pre-assumption, they are not extensible. So what I see in my project is the common perception, everything has to be an EJB. So there is what to do with POJOS or legacy frameworks, how to do that. And actually, what you can do, you can build one interceptor, which intercepts the calls. And this interceptor can has access to the instance of the bean and can inject whatever you want. So on the slides, you will see I have a sample how to do with juice. So you can inject juice beans into your EJB and use juice annotations. It takes exactly three lines of code. And okay, it is an option. It's an interesting option. So you can, but even more important, EJB 3 are lightweight enough to be used as a general purpose component. There is no need to use POJOS and wrapping POJOS in EJB 3 anymore. So EJB are too slow in regards performance, and is also not true. I tested the performance with Glassfish V2 and V3, and there was only one dynamic proxy which consumed the performance, and it was 3% difference between a POJO, empty POJO, and an EJB, and it was actually not measurable. It were about, in worst case, 7 milliseconds difference. So there is nothing in enterprise. If you access a database, you get, I don't know, 300-500 milliseconds difference. So just doesn't matter.
So yeah, I mean, and the whole purpose of EJB is the more complex situation of business logic. So you have, compared with the POJO, you know, you don't have to worry about a lot of things with the POJO. With the EJB, you have all kinds of issues where you're trying to make sure that your persistence works properly and everything else. So it's a much more powerful tool. So for it to be able to keep up, you know, to match POJO in terms of a just instantiation state it means that it really is lightweight in itself.
Yeah. It's lightweight, it is not exactly a POJO, or we have to redefine POJOs, because behind the scenes it gets wrapped with a kind of aspect. But what you gain, so the killer feature is actually that if you get in-flying requests or transactions, there is it's impossible to access from two transactions one EJB. And this is actually, in my eyes, the killer feature, because it could cause inconsistent systems, and with EJB, it's just solved.
Right.
Perfect. EJBs are too complex. This is actually your point. The problem is there is something like essential complexity and the accidental complexity. And the essential complexity is something like if you're working with distributed systems, you have to think about synchronization, how to deal with caching and distribution. So we can do nothing to simplify that, because it's the nature of the system. Thanks. And what we can do, we can provide something, we can fight the accidental complexity. And actually, as I said, it's just one annotation. And if you provide this annotation, you get another configuration defaulted for instance transactions. So required does mean every method is transactional per default. If you don't like that, you can set it on or off. So it depends on you. So you have to override the standard, the convention. So the next point, EJBs are hard to develop. So, and this was very true in J2E14. You needed specific tools to build your enterprise applications. And now actually it's no more true. You can go with VI or Emacs. You have to have only one single jar in a class path. It's the API, about 50K. And then you can compile whatever you want. And most application servers provide even deploy on safe or incremental deployment. So if you compile your EJB, it gets redeployed on the fly.
Mm-hmm.
It's provided by JBoss, Glassfish V2, V3, and so forth. So it's very incremental and agile development process.
Right, you don't have to restart.
Restart, redeploy, and the whole ceremony to get Hello World on the screen.
Right.
So
it's
basically gone. So on this slide, you see the simplest possible EJB. There is just one POJO without an interface, nothing, and one at stateless annotation, which is required. So how to compile that? You need the EJB3 API. How to deploy that? You have to build a jar, just with a jar tool, without any XML or something like this, and put this jar to auto-deploy to a Glassfish, for instance. Or applications, I guess, is called in JBoss, so they're exactly the same. Perfect. So now let's start with architecture. So we covered the pre-assumption that EJB, and would like to introduce some architectural principles which change very much. And the background is, what I see in my projects is, people try to develop Java EE5 applications with the old J2E1.4 styled architecture, with many superfluous layers, tiers, indirections, and so forth. And this is no more needed. So I would like to explain briefly domain-driven and service-oriented architecture, so both styles. We'll start with Agile Manifesto. It's very interesting. So the most important thing is working software over comprehensive documentation, of course, responding to change. And I have the last point comes from me, pragmatic solutions over infinite layers, indirections, frameworks, and patterns. So that's what I like, just be pragmatic and don't try to over-engineer a system. And this is my perception in projects. The architects try to do that. They build too many layers, abstractions, patterns, whatever they saw in talks, sessions, and books, and then complain that J2E is too complicated. Don't have to. Perfect. So what you can do, you can model your architecture or express your architecture, either it is service-oriented or model domain-driven, with the old entity control and boundary elements. So you can say whatever you do, you need boundary first, is the interaction between the user and the system. You need control, is the essential business logic. And the entity is something like domain object, which is mostly persistent because you have to persist the data. And with those three elements are actually enough to model either service-oriented or domain-driven architectures with Java E5. So let's start with this SOA architecture. There's a diagram which shows all patterns, and the key difference between SOA and domain-driven is the stronger encapsulation in the rich metadata. So if you're building service-oriented systems, it is essential that the external interface do not change. It cannot change. It has to be stable. So it means you have to have the boundary of a service-oriented architecture is a session B, and all parameters, return values, and exceptions have to be stored somewhere in a neutral place, and they cannot come from the realization of the component, because you cannot be dependent on the internal implementation of a component. So it pre-assumes transfer objects, because you cannot transfer persistent entities like JPA, because they come from database. You have to use dedicated objects which belongs to the API and not the implementation. And this is actually the essential overhead of SOA. So you need the encapsulation, otherwise a small change in the component could break many clients. So you need something like, I call it service facade, because it's facade to other services. Why it's important? The service facade provides additional qualities like transactions, security, probably state management, monitoring, service level agreements. What you can do with a service facade, you can decorate the service facade with an interceptor, and the interceptor can measure the performance and escalate slow methods, for instance. So a service facade is very like typical Gang of Four facade. It's just a controller. It controls or use case controller. The service itself is the business logic. So typically, a service facade coordinates services, and the services are reusable, and the service facade is more use case bound, so it's application specific. And the services are transient, so they have no persistent state, but they are using domain objects, which are anemic. So it's a typical, actually a service-oriented architecture is procedural. You have services and you have objects, but there is no, persistent structures actually. But the persistent structure contains only getters and setters and attributes, but there is no behavior. So this is basically the simplest possible SOA architecture containing a service facade, so stateless session beans with remote interfaces or local interfaces, with a service interface which is always local, because you don't like to expose it directly. It is not transactional. It relies on transactions and persistent structures. And what I do then, I provide three layers in the component with package names like boundary control entity, Why? To measure the quality. So there are different tools which allows you then, JDepend, for instance, or XRadar, which allows you to measure whether, for instance, an entity accesses a service or service facet. So you can specify the allowed dependencies between those layers. So this is the very brief introduction to service-oriented architecture. And there are lots of patterns which are optional. Yeah. Perfect. Service facet, it changed, the intention changed. In J2E14, the service facet was mandatory because it wrapped the entity beans. It was workaround. So the entity beans, they had a lot of, they were heavyweight. So they had local interfaces, remote interfaces. Someone had to coordinate those interfaces. And this was the job actually of a session facet, and it was mandatory. In Java 5, it's not needed as a workaround. It's only needed as a conceptual pattern. It's the boundary to the system. So this is the main difference. So the next part is what you can do actually with service facet. You can provide two views. It's a trick. You have a remote view, which is always stable, and which is a just remote EGB3 interface. Then local view, this is also EGB3 interface. EGB3 interface is just a POGI, but it will be an EGB business interface. And the local interface inherits from the remote interface and is basically empty at the first time. If you expose the remote interface, you can extend the local interface without breaking the remote clients. So you have something like package visibility. I get the question asked a lot how to do that. And there is a significant difference. If you access the bean locally, all parameters and return values are passed by reference, and remotely is always copied. So it's interesting part. So the service itself is actually the pure business logic, and it comes with actually an interesting setting, transaction attribute mandatory. What does it mean? It needs transactions. So you cannot access the service without transactions. Why it's needed? Because in SOA, every method has to be atomic. So if you do something, it has to be consistent. So the facet has to start transactions, and the services have to reuse these transactions. So, and this is actually the case. So the service is like a private method, and the service facet can be considered as a public method, which starts the transactions and propagates them to the services. Perfect. It's just a local bean, it's stateless, and the transaction attribute is mandatory. So now we covered more or less SOA. I would like to introduce you domain-driven design. What's the difference? First, what is domain-driven design? Actually, it is nothing else than object-oriented software doing right. So you concentrate on the domain concepts, on the target domain, and try to emphasize the business and not the technology. And the main difference is in SOA, you try to model the business process. So everything is like a task, resources, activities. And in domain-driven design, you try to emphasize the core domain objects like order or something like this, and there are no services outside. It's like the domain object itself is encapsulated and have already the actions. So the main difference also is domain-driven systems are rather stateful because these objects which exchange messages, and service-oriented architectures are stateless because they have to be stateless because every method is transactional and there is no need to maintain a state between the methods.
So really it's a different way of organizing. You could do the same types of things, but it's a very different way of structuring the organizing the application and the server and the components.
Yeah.
Right.
Exactly. And the more complex your logic is, the more easier you can go with domain-driven design.
Mm-hmm.
And the more, not simpler, but for instance, most of the e-commerce applications, there is no need for complex business logic. So you can go safely with SOA.
Mm-hmm.
But the key challenge is to identify early which kind of style you would like to use. And domain-driven architecture, the main difference is there is basically no encapsulation on the component level. So instead of a service facet, to encapsulate the realization, you provide a gateway component which tries to expose as much as possible. Why this? Because the domain objects are real objects, they are encapsulated, they are persistent. If you expose those objects directly to the view, you can bind to the objects and you are basically done. And this sounds strange, like a fat client, but this is the new trend actually. If you consider frameworks like Seam or something, it's exactly what happens. If you introduce Seam or GSR299, Java Context and Dependency Injection, you can even use those entities without a gateway directly to bind it to a JSF. And what's actually the benefit doing so is the inheritance. So in SOA, there is, even if you have inheritance, you have always distinct in services which type you are using. So you have to say, like, if you order, you are the default order, then proceed this way. If you are a specific order, then do that way. In object-oriented systems, you get the object back and can invoke your methods. And this is really, really easy to maintain. So it's a forgotten object-oriented actual feature, yeah? Okay. So you have only a gateway and persistent domain objects. And those persistent domain objects are object-oriented, well encapsulated, is just objects, just well-done objects. But they don't have necessary getters and setters. They have private encapsulated state and, semantic rich methods. So there is no get address and set address with something like change address where you pass the old address or something like this. Mm-hmm. And there are several tricks like fluent interface or providing builder to make even DSL-like. So Java has its boundaries regarding DSL, but you can even build domain-specific languages like expressions. So the persistent domain object is... So how to start in projects, in real-world project with that? First, if you have concentrate on your business and forget about Java E. So you should model your domain object as you like to. And then you can apply your persistent annotations. And after all, you provide per component. For every component, you provide a gateway which exposes the internal objects. And actually, in domain-driven design, the gateway is something like a domain repository. So it returns the root entity, and the client can freely navigate through the relations. And there is another great, actually, feature. If you're doing so, you have no problems with lazy and eager loading. Because if you bind the first entity to the view and traverse the relations, the entity manager loads the entities for you. In SOA world, you have to know in advance which path has to be eager loaded for the client. So there are some problems with that. About the main difference, if you have in a SOA system too many instances of checks or something like your object, you are type of or get type, you are a type of specific domain object, then you probably have to think about switching to domain driven design because
you've got too much logic determining what needs to be done next, based on...
And even worse, this logic tends to replicate over different services because you need the distinction over and over again in different components, so you are no more dry, don't repeat yourself. So. And it could be really bad. So I saw systems where actually no one knew what actually happened because of the type distinctions. Even worse, if you would like to introduce a new type, you have to find all these places and extend them. And in domain-driven designs, there's no big deal because you rely only on the signature of the abstract class and you can introduce whatever you want and it will work. It's a lot easier to test. It has some disadvantages as well because it's stateful. And stateful, you have to be careful about the memory consumption and so forth. But in my perspective, you should start with something which is very, very easy to maintain. And as soon as possible, start some load tests to find out whether your non-functional requirements can be met or not. This would be my suggestion.
And it would seem that today, with such a focus on new technologies for rich clients and everything, that more in a lot of cases it will make more sense that you can use the stateful method because you do have the technology on the client side that can really cope with and work with a complex object.
Exactly, and what you could actually do, something like hybrid components. So you can EGB3 are embeddable, so they are very lightweight. You could even start the whole system at the client side.
Mm-hmm.
Why not? And then you can access the JPA entities directly with cache database,
mm-hmm.
and you can deploy the same component on the server and provide the same business logic for Java server faces and whatnot,
mm-hmm.
for the viewer, even expose them via SLA, like service.
Mm-hmm.
And this is actually a trend what I see with Adobe Air, Google Gears. They are basically fat clients.
Right.
You know,
yeah.
There's a database encrypted
yeah.
on the client, and they access the database directly. And we can do that even better with Java, JavaFX. Plus,
mm-hmm.
you know, you can write a very thin wrapper around your JPA entities, and binding is still a problem. Hopefully, it will get fixed. But then you could very rich applications, and
right.
they access a local store.
Mm-hmm.
Perfect. So I have a small example, like a load example. You have load, which consists of several order items, and you have something like lightweight item, standard item, and bulky item, and you would like to compute the shipping costs differently,
mm-hmm.
for instance. So let's say lightweight item is cheaper, and standard item is standard and bulky very expensive, so you have to distinguish somehow how the price is computed. In the SOA world, I have here a switch statement in case bulky, lightweight, and standard, and I determine first of what type the object is, and then in every case, as it says, shipping costs for bulky are default cost plus firm, minus one, and so forth. In the object-oriented way, I have only one statement, is order item, get shipping cost. So I can fetch the object from the database, and it is. This is a very small example. It gets even more interesting if you update the objects, because you can say to the root entity, I don't know, prove bulky items, and you can go iterate over the objects and prune them. In SOA world, you had everything outside because there is no logic in the entities. So there is, yeah, interesting shift happens right now. Okay, the next interesting thing is how to construct such object. In SOA world, you would do something like load new load, order item, and then invoke a bulk of setters and getters to construct everything. And there is another way, a fluent way, with builder, the next Gengo 4 pattern almost forgotten. What you can do, load builder with standard item, with lightweight item, with bulky item build. And on the previous slide, I have about, it's hard to say, 20, 30 lines of code, and then the domain-driven slide, exactly one line of code, but I formatted differently, so are actually four. But this is one statement, right? So, and what's interesting also, what you should do in your domain-driven, regardless of whether the architecture is domain-driven or service-oriented, you should be explicit what we are doing. So what does it mean? If you have concept like domain object, what I like to do, I provide a sub-package with the name domain, sub-package with service, so I know then, okay, in the sub-package domain, there are sitting only domain objects in there, in service and so on. So if you open a component, it's always the same structure. So this is what pays off, because then you can apply quality tools, Xradar, SonarJ, or whatever, which measure the dependencies and so forth. Okay, what's the gateway? So I mentioned the gateway, and this is the interesting story, is what is it actually? And the gateway is very lean and very interesting as well, because it sounds crazy for J2E developer for the first time. The bean is stateful, and on the you set off all transactions. So what you do is a transaction attribute type not supported. What does it mean? There are basically no transactions. So what happens then? The bean is stateful, there are no transactions. What you can do then, you can inject an extended entity manager. And the extended entity manager keeps the persistence entities attached to the storage. So you can invoke as many methods you like to, and there is no need to synchronize with the database. And if the bean is not supported, what does it mean? If you fetch the data from the database, change the entities, there is no commit to the database. Even though you will see perhaps inserts and updates, but there is no commit.
Mm-hmm.
So what you need then, one single method, save, and this method overrides the default with requires new. if you invoke from your view the method save, all your changes or your changes will be automatically detected by the entity manager and flushed to the database. In service oriented system, it's actually job of the client. The client had to compute all the deltas, all the changes, and send back to the server. And this is actually a huge simplification if you think about this. The trade-off again, stateful. You have stateful cache per session. So this is a trade-off. And what the gateway does actually returns the first entity. In my case, it's the current load. And then the client can freely navigate to the items and so forth. So it fits on one keynote page. Okay. So we basically done. We can extend our discussions on how we...
To me this is very interesting because, I've been a developer for quite a long time and saw the beginnings, when the web was when the web started being used for client server. You know, the first big problem was, stateful objects are a big problem.
Yeah.
and so then we had the evolution. No, we can't have any state.
In my eyes, everything repeats in 10 years. So if you wait long enough, you get in the next cycle exactly what you did 10 years before, you get over. Yeah,
that's what seems like it's happening, yes.
But the funny story, though, stateful session beats were always faster than stateless because the application server returned to the same sticky sessions, to the same node over and over again. There was no tricks.
Right.
And with stateless session beats, they tried to optimize that. Try to, is there a session bin in a pool? If not, create one. And there was a slight over it, minimal, but it was.
Yes.
And the problem with stateful is replication. If you have to replicate a state, you have a problem. But if you have stateful session beans or HTTP session, for instance, why to replicate? Because per definition, this state is not persistent. So you have to leave with a failure. Because most of the application server, they provided in-memory replication. And in-memory replication does mean it is asynchronous. So it's not persistent. So what I did, I never replicated a stateful, and the only one problem is memory consumption, and you can easily test that. So you're absolutely right. Everything repeats. Everything was stateless with SOA, and now we have so domain-driven revival, and I guess it will be exaggerated in the other direction. Until some project will fail, then we'll come back to a stateless with other term. So
right,
guarantee you.
Right. It's a spiral.
Yeah, this is a spiral with different names, different products. Yeah. Exactly.
Okay. All right. Well, that was very interesting. I'm glad you decided to do this podcast with me. And
I forgot one thing. Most of the examples are checked in Java.NET projects, patterns for Java 5, and I have about 100 observers. This is hard to say because there is no way to count them, right?
Yeah, I don't know.
So I get requests and everything is open source, and
okay. Right.
And check out my blog, blog.adambean.com.
Excellent. I will do that. All right. Thank you.
Thank you very much.